Well, good evening. It's good to see everybody here. Thank you so much for being here again, and I encourage you once again to open up your Bible and read along. We're going to get to do a lot of reading tonight, as we are going to be looking at this subject from the Old Testament. Now, there are some things that really do change our lives. I've been listening to, some of you are older than me. Some of you are, in fact, older than me. And so I've been listening to things like living in homes without electricity and living in homes without running water. That's never been my life. And I imagine getting electricity and running water in your home has been pretty significant change to your life. To me, the biggest significant change has been a cell phone. I mean, that has been tremendous. It has made it to where when I go to the store, I always get everything Bonnie wants me to get. Because if I forget, I can call her rather than going home and realizing I've missed it. But bigger than that, I don't ask for directions anymore. I'm never lost. And I love that. Cell phones have really changed my life. But there has been nothing, no invention, nothing that has occurred that will change our lives more than the resurrection. More than the thought that death no longer rules. That death is temporary. That when we get to the New Testament, death would be referred to as sleep. And I've never feared sleep. It changes everything. And I want us to look then at the impact of the resurrection in the Old Testament. And just out of curiosity, you can if you want to. You don't have to. I'm not going to judge you. But if you want to, you can raise up your hand or your hands. How many resurrections were there in the Old Testament? Think about it. No guessers. See, some congregations, I made them guess. And now I gave you a way out and everybody took it. Oh, no. Very close. It's three. So we're going to cover six of them. So there are only three actual resurrections in the Old Testament. But there are several pictures of resurrections, things that are right on the cusp of a resurrection. And so we're going to treat it like that because it is the same message. And each time we go to them, I want us to stop and think, why is it here? What do we learn from this? And I would just like to quickly remind you, and I think you already know this, I'm so pleased to hear that you do studies of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is not this archaic message. It's not a message that was written to the Jews and we just happen to read it every now and then. No, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11, Paul writes to Christians speaking of the Old Testament, and he says, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. It's for us. The Old Testament is a Christian book. While yes, we're not under the old law, the message and the lessons is nonetheless for us. The pictures of God are nonetheless for us. So we're going to start off in Genesis chapter 22. And this is not a technically accurate resurrection because no death actually takes place. But it is, for all intents and purposes, a resurrection. And I'm not making that up. That's something the Bible itself tells us. It is where Abraham has been promised that through him, God was going to make a great nation. Through him, all the peoples of the world would be blessed. And he has the son that God has said through him, through Isaac, all of these promises are going to be fulfilled. And then God does the most bizarre thing ever. He says, now kill him. Genesis 22, starting in verse 1. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. And go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son And he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you." Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took it in his hand, the fire and the knife, so the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham!" And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And so we have this instance where God has said, "I want you to kill your son Isaac." And did you notice how long the journey was? It's 3 days. And it doesn't take very long to very quickly see that there are a whole lot of parallels going on here between what's happening with Isaac and what happens with Jesus on the cross, and he's in the grave for 3 days. You have Abraham being told to offer up his only son. God is offering up his only begotten son. So many parallels that are occurring within here. And what that means is, when you really think about it, 3 days, Isaac's dead. The moment God gives the command for Abraham, Isaac is dead. And 3 days later, he's not. 3 days later, they come to the place where the sacrifice would be offered. He's going to go through with what he said he would do, and God stops him, and he gives him his son back. What are we supposed to learn from this? To me, God has never asked anything harder of anyone. That's, I guess, my opinion. I don't know if anybody would have a differing opinion, but has God ever asked us to do something more difficult than to go to Abraham? And God is not ignorant of the challenge here. God is not coming up to Abraham and saying, "This is no big deal, I just want you to offer up a son." He says, "I want you to offer up your son. Your only son, the one you love." He keeps emphasizing the significance of this sacrifice, the significance of this command. You want to know what resurrection does for us? It makes it to where God can't ask anything that's too much. Because Abraham's looking at it, and we learn about this in Hebrews chapter 11. We learn that Abraham was able to go through with this because he had a tremendous amount of faith. Even though there had never been, to our knowledge, a resurrection from the dead before. And even though God had not promised him that he would resurrect his son from the dead, Abraham had such faith in God's power and such faith in God's promise that he saw no other way than, "God's going to raise my son back from the dead. I can sacrifice him and he will be back." So in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17, it says, "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, 'In Isaac your descendants shall be called.' He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type." You see here, when he says he received him back as a type, what he's saying is, here is a picture of Jesus' resurrection when you look at Abraham with Isaac. So it is, in fact, a picture of the resurrection. But what it just showed us was, if you believe that this life or this coming death is temporary, It changes what you're willing to give up. It changes what you're willing to sacrifice. That may have been the hardest command ever given, but it's not the only hard command. God has asked some people to do some very difficult things. Jesus teaches in Matthew chapter 19 that marriage isn't the way the world sees it, that marriage is permanent, and that you're not just allowed to divorce and remarry at will. And so he says in Matthew 19 verse 9, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. There are people out there, there are Christians out there who out of just unfortunate circumstances, and sometimes it's completely out of their control, God is commanding that they be alone the rest of their life. Now that may not be the same as us asking you to offer up your son, but that's a hard one. How do you do it? I know on the surface, it seems so long. Years of loneliness. Years of struggle. But it is so small when you think about the resurrection. It means that, yes, I'm going to have to make sacrifices in this life, but what comes next, what happens after that, is when the promises are fulfilled. That's when life really happens. And if I have to sacrifice pleasures in this time, it's worth it for the next time. When we can't focus on the next time, we won't sacrifice anything for this time. And we're living in a world that is telling everybody, this life is short, just live however you want to live. And if there's any sort of desire you have within yourself, no matter how perverted it might have been in previous times, you go ahead and follow it, and the rest of the world needs to accept you for it. And what it's saying is, as Christians, when we say no, we are denying ourselves. And you know what? That's exactly right. We're denying our pleasures. We're denying ourselves. We're sacrificing. But we're doing it because we believe in the resurrection. Yes, I may give up this life, but I do it for the next. Isn't that what Paul's saying in Philippians? Paul talks about all of these things he had, all these gifts and spiritual things that he had. He was respected by his nation. He was the chief most. He was everything. And he says, I consider that rubbish, trash. And now he's living his life where every place he goes, he's being arrested, he's being stoned, he's going through shipwrecks, he's going through nights in the deep, he's going through hunger and suffering. He is miserable in that regard. Everybody would look at him and think of him as miserable in that regard. Why? Resurrection. It's not for this life. I sacrifice this life for the next. This is what Abraham shows us. If you focus on the resurrection, there is nothing God can ask of you that's too much. Now the second resurrection I want us to consider is also not an actual physical resurrection. But when there's a death sentence that is given and a death sentence that is carried out and somebody survives it, I think that's going to qualify. That was death poured down upon somebody and they survive it. And this is, of course, Daniel chapter 3. When we have three friends of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and they find themselves in a circumstance where there is a life and death situation, they've been commanded by the ultimate leader of their time to bow down and worship. So let's start off in verses 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Now, they have made it very clear how significant this is. We're going to have this opportunity. There's going to be a moment. I'm going to tell you when. Everybody bow down or you die. Now, we know what happens, right? They play. Everybody bows down. And boy, it's got to be really obvious when everybody's bowing down when you don't. Three guys don't. And everybody sees. So we pick up in verse 12, the accusation that is made. "There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire, and what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded. He stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of blazing fire. He responded and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on their bodies of these men. Nor was the hair of their head singed, nor was their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. Do you not see that as a picture of the resurrection? These are people that they have been given a death sentence, and it is serious. It is so powerful that the men who threw them in, they die. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are thrown in, and they don't die. And what do? They come out untouched, unscathed. Not even the smell of death, the smell of fire was upon them. So what are we supposed to learn from this? Well, what if Nebuchadnezzar, as he pulls these three men out, says, "Oh, now I'm really angry. I'm going to get this fire up 14 times hotter than usual." What would Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do? Nothing different. You know what the resurrection does for us? It takes away fear. What should we be afraid of if all men can do is kill us and God can bring us right back? That is, in fact, one of the jokes to me of the Bible. In John chapter 12, we talked about Lazarus on Sunday evening. And I just laugh at what happens in the next chapter. Because Lazarus has been resurrected from the dead and people have heard about it. And so they're coming from all over the place. And it tells us in John 12, verses 9 through 11, that they're coming not just to see Jesus, but they want to see Lazarus. And seeing Lazarus, they come to believe in Jesus. And you know what the Pharisees and the government comes up with this brilliant idea? I know what we'll do. We'll kill him. Now, if you're Lazarus, how afraid of that are you? I've been dead. This guy can bring me back. Do your worst. That is what the resurrection does for us. It takes fear completely away. And that disarms our enemy. Not the government. It disarms our real enemy. It disarms Satan. Hebrews chapter 2 talks about Jesus and how he shares in suffering. How he shares in what we go through. And Hebrews 2 and verse 14 says, "Therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise also partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives." Satan's great power against Christians, his great power against mankind has been fear. All he has to do is do what Nebuchadnezzar did. All he has to do is threaten you. "I will kill you if you don't do what I say to do." And people will do it. But Jesus has come and conquered death. Nebuchadnezzar had run into Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who didn't fear death, who believed in a God who could conquer death. And as a result, no matter what the government says, no matter what Satan threatens, we won't change. We won't give in. We won't fall. So, recently we've had a little bit of an issue with a virus, right? Everybody got, you guys have that? Did that happen out here? COVID? You heard of that? Okay. Yeah. That was interesting. It put us in an interesting position. We had government shutting down churches. We had Christians staying at home. Now, I am well aware that this is a complex subject. And I'm not going to come in and say, here's how it should be exactly, and here's what every church needed to do, or anything like that. I recognize that sometimes when you face persecution, you stand and you get hit and you get hurt. And sometimes when you face persecution, well, everybody in Jerusalem scatters. Sometimes there's self-preservation. I understand that this is not super simple. But if churches shut down because they were afraid of the government, that was wrong. And if we are afraid of a virus, we are weak. Can the virus kill us? Yes, it can. And God can make us live again. And when we believe in God's power over death, we don't fear death. Death becomes sleep. Now remember, I still believe in self-preservation. I still believe in you wearing seatbelts. I believe in locking your door. I believe in all sorts of things. I don't want you to think that I'm oversimplifying this. I'm just saying that if our motivation, if our reason for shutting doors to the church building was fear of what the government would say, that was not the right thing to do. And if our reason for not coming to assembly is because we're afraid of death, that's also not the right thing to do. We should not fear death. We should be like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and say, do your worst, I serve a God who's stronger. So the third point I want to make is actually when we get to finally the physical resurrection. See, with Abraham, he thought about it in a hypothetical sense. God could do it, but we hadn't seen it happen. But then we get to the three actual resurrections. And so we're going to talk about Elijah, Elisha, and Elisha. So in 1 Kings chapter 17, this is when the great drought is beginning. That great drought in which Elijah has told Ahab, it's not going to rain again. And then for 3.5 years, there's not going to be any rain. And all the people of Israel are suffering and they're struggling. And even Elijah himself is caught up into the problem, except for God's going to provide for Elijah. And through various means, God has provided for Elijah. But in verse 8, God's going to send him to a widow. And as we read about Elijah, Elisha, and Elisha, I want you to be thinking, what's the point? And if your only point you come up with is God's more powerful than death, that's not wrong, but that's not the point we're going to go for. That's kind of redundant on a subject of the resurrection. We're looking for something more. What's the point? Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and stay there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. So he arose and went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks, and he called to her and said, please get me a little water in a jar that I may drink. And she was going to get it. He called to her and said, please bring me a piece of bread in your hand. But she said, as the Lord your God lives, I have no bread, only a handful of flour in the bowl and a little oil in the jar. And behold, I am gathering a few sticks that I may go in and prepare for me and my son, that we may eat it and die. Then Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go, do as you have said, but make me a little bread cake from it first, and bring it out to me. And afterward you may make one for yourself and for your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bowl of flour shall not be exhausted, nor shall the jar of oil be empty, until the day of the Lord sends rain on the face of the earth. So she went out and did according to the word of Elijah, and she and he and her household ate for many days. Now that was an act of faith, was that not? To give the last of her food to him first? Keep going. The bowl of flour was not exhausted, nor did the jar of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke through Elijah. Now it came about, after these things, that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became sick. And his sickness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. So she said to Elijah, what do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my iniquity to remembrance and to put my son to death. He said to her, give me your son. Then he took him from her bosom and carried him up to the upper room where he was living and laid him on his own bed. He called to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and called to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, I pray you, let this child's life return to him. The Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child returned to him, and he revived. Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, see, your son is alive. Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." The next one in 2 Kings chapter 4 has some similarities. Now you have another prophet of God. This time it's Elisha. And we're going to read starting off in verse 8. "Now there came a day when Elisha passed over to Shunem, where there was a prominent woman, and she persuaded him to eat food. And so it was, as often as he passed, he turned in there to eat food. But she said to her husband, 'Behold, now I perceive that this is a holy man of God passing by us continually. Please, let us make a little walled upper chamber, and let us set a bed for him there, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand, and it shall be, when he comes to us, that he can turn in there.'" And so Elisha, from then on, he just turns in there, and he has a place to stay, and he has some food, and he says, "I want to do something for this woman." His servant tells him, "You know what she really could use? She doesn't have a kid." And so he says, "I'll give her a kid." So he tells her, "You're going to have a kid this time next year." She doesn't believe it, but guess what? That's what happens. And then things fall apart for her. So pick up in verse 18. "When the child was grown, the day came that he went out to his father to the reapers. He said to his father, 'My head, my head.' And he said to his servant, 'Carry him to his mother.' When he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon and then died. She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door behind him and went out. Then she called to her husband and said, 'Please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return.' He said, 'Why will you go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath.' And she said, 'It will be well.' Then she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, 'Drive and go forward. Do not slow down the pace for me unless I tell you.' So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. When the man of God saw her at a distance, he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Behold, there's the Shunammite. Please run now to meet her and say to her, "Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with your child?" And she answered, "It is well." When she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught hold of his feet, and Gehazi came near to push her away. But the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is troubled within her, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has not told me." Then she said, "Did I ask for a son from my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'?" Then he said to Gehazi, "Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, do not salute him. And if anyone salutes you, do not answer him, and lay my staff on the lad's face." The mother of the lad said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." And he arose and followed her. Then Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was no sound or response. So he returned to meet him and told him. The lad was not awakened. When Elisha came into the house, behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. So he entered and shut the door behind them both and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on the mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hands. And he stretched himself on him, and the flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked in the house once back and forth. And he went up and stretched himself on him, and the lad sneezed 7 times, and the lad opened his eyes. He called Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her, and when she came into him, he said, "Take up your son." Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground, and she took up her son and went out. Now, I'll say she has a tremendous amount of faith too, doesn't she? As she's saying, "Everything's going to be fine. Everything's fine. My son's dead, but it's all going to be fine." That's a lot of faith right there. But she was right. It worked out. And then there's the most bizarre resurrection in all of the Bible. In 2 Kings chapter 13, Elisha dies. 2 Kings 13, starting in verse 20, it says, "Elisha died, and they buried him. Now the bands of the Moabites would invade the land in the spring of the year. As they were burying a man, behold, they saw a marauding band, and they cast the man into the grave of Elisha. And when the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. Now that was just what looked weird, right? So you got these guys that are getting ready to bury somebody. They see an army. They freak out. They're like, here, just throw him in there. They throw him in there and he comes out. And they go, okay. And then they run. I'm assuming they run at that point. And so that's just a really bizarre resurrection. It only takes two verses. Oftentimes it's forgotten. What's the point? What's the lesson? Well, here's what I know. If for some reason I go off the deep end and I start doing all sorts of crimes and I get arrested and they give me the life sentence and they give me a chance, say, you have one final request. I'll say, bury me in that grave. Tricked you, right? Bury me in that grave and I'll get to be alive again. I think that's actually the point. It's the same point for all three resurrections. You know what it's all about? It's about who you know. It's about who you're close to. During the time of the famine, there are so many people who are starving. But Elijah, who's a servant of God, he's got food. There are so many kids dying. But only the woman who served Elijah has her son resurrected. With Elisha, you have this woman who creates a place for a prophet. And as a matter of having this prophet so close and so near, she now has access to this power and to this blessings. She gets a son because she's blessing a prophet. Her son dies, but she has him resurrected because she knows the prophet. The prophet recognizes her. The prophet loves her and wants to help her. It's all about who you know or which grave you get thrown in. Think about what that means to us. The only thing that matters in life is the one relationship that matters in death. It's knowing the one who can resurrect. Now consider this. Setting aside the really weird one with the bones, there's a lot of to-do in the resurrections. Right? So there's getting up, getting down, getting up, getting down, getting up, getting down. There's praying to God. There's laying on top of them. There's kind of like this, I'm trying to transfer my life into theirs. And I don't want to undermine this. This is a tremendous thing. This is death being overcome and life being given back to these kids. This is a big thing, but do you see how it's a big deal? Wouldn't it be great if there was somebody, I don't know, who could come up and just say, get up to the dead and they do it? Like Jesus. Get up, little girl. She gets up. Come out, Lazarus. He comes out. Wake up to the son that was dead. Jesus has more power. And what that means is your life is an absolute waste if it's not spent pursuing a relationship with him. When I was in college, eventually I figured out that what was more important than my education was getting a good wife. Specifically, Bonnie. I had figured out that she was the woman for me. And you know what I did then? I changed my days for her. I made sure that my schedule was such that when she got out of class, I was there. If she was hungry, I made sure I would go and get her food. I changed my diet for her. I changed it to where I no longer ate onions because she couldn't stand onions and she wouldn't want to be near me if I'd eaten onions. So I said, no more onions. And I did not complain about it because the only thing that mattered to me was that I won her. That's our life with Jesus. The only thing that matters is that he and you are together. That you are in him and he is in you. Because if he's in you when you die, you are friends with the one who can resurrect you. And so the rest of our lives, it's not about what job you have. It's not about furthering your education. It's not about getting more money. It's not about retirement. It's not about anything more than this. Spend your time in your life getting as close to Jesus as you can. Changing anything and everything it takes to be near to him, to love him and be loved by him, to be close to him. So in Revelation chapter 14 and verse 13, It's this relationship that makes all the difference. I heard a voice from heaven saying, "Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow after them." But do you see, it's in the Lord. That's the key here. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 14, this passage about how we comfort one another when loved ones have died, the picture of Jesus returning is here. If we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with Him those who have fallen asleep in Jesus. It's the relationship. If they were in Jesus when they died, they'll be with Jesus when He returns. And so we need to consider that the only thing that matters today, tomorrow, is what we can do to be close to Jesus. How we can please Him. How we can serve Him. Make that relationship the most important relationship of your life. Fourth point that we want to make, that if you're counting, if you can count up to six, I'm sure we all can. Sixth resurrection that we're going to consider is from Ezekiel, and it's the most blatant picture of resurrection there is in the Old Testament. It's Ezekiel chapter 37 and the Valley of the Dry Bones. The book of Ezekiel is written during the time in which God's people have been taken into captivity. The temple has been destroyed at this point. And the people now are in Babylon, and they are in desperate situation. And the book of Ezekiel makes a transition as this is going on. Before the temple is destroyed, he is trying to convince them that there's still judgment to come, there's still punishment to come. But then, once the temple is destroyed and all the rest of the people are taken into captivity, they lose all hope, and all of a sudden Ezekiel starts talking about hopeful things. It's like, you guys think it's all over now. It's not all over. And so Ezekiel receives this vision. Starting in verse 1, it says, "The hand of the Lord was upon me, and He brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me down in the middle of the valley, and it was full of bones. He caused me to pass among them round about, and behold, they were very many on the surface of the valley, and lo, they were very dry. And He said to me, Son of man, can these bones live? And I answered, O Lord God, You know. Again, He said to me, prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God to these bones, behold, I will cause breath to enter you that you may come to life. I will put sinews on you and make flesh grow back on you, cover you with skin and put breath in you that you may come alive and you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I prophesied, there was a noise and behold, a rattling. And the bones came together, bone to its bone. And I looked, and behold, sinews were on them, and flesh grew, and skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. Then He said to me, prophesy to the breath, prophesy, son of man. And He said to the breath, thus says the Lord God, come from the four winds, O breath, and breathe on these slain, that they come to life. So I prophesied as He commanded me, and the breath came into them, and they came to life, and stood on their feet, an exceedingly great army." I mean, there's just no way to not see that as a resurrection. That's what it is, right? And it is the resurrection. You have so many resurrections occurring at one time. And the emphasis here is on these things were dead, dead, dead. They were just bones, dried bones, and they're scattered all over the place, and there's a ton of them, and God resurrects them. You understand what death is, right? James chapter 2 teaches us the basic principle of death is separation. It's when two things that should be together get separated. So, what is death? Death is a body and a soul separated. They both exist, but they no longer exist together. And so then he talks about faith and works, and they should be together. But when they're not, when you have faith without works, it is dead. And so then we talk about spiritual death, and spiritual death is a man with God. And when they are separated, you are spiritually dead. He's actually talking about a different type of death here. He's talking about national death. That is a people and their lands separated. He goes on in verse 11. He says, "Then he said to me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried up and our hope has perished. We are completely cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves, my people, and I will bring you into the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord, when I have opened your graves and caused you to come up out of your graves, my people. I will put my spirit within you, and you will come to life, and I will place you on your own land. Then you will know that I, the Lord, have spoken and done it, declares the Lord." The most immediate fulfillment, the most immediate meaning of Ezekiel chapter 37 is that the people who had been taken into captivity away from their land were going to go home. You're going to be made alive, even though it seems so impossible. And yet he has given us a picture and an image of something much, much bigger. And that is, there is a day coming when all of those who are dead and in the grave will hear the voice of Jesus and will once more live. But he has added something to this. Jesus will resurrect the dead who are dead, dead, dead. The dead who are more than just a little bit dead, but who has bodies have completely decayed. Sometimes people wonder about, you know, cremation, and I don't want to get into that too much, but I want to get into the very basic subject there, where sometimes people are afraid that, you know, if I get put into a bunch of ashes and my ashes are spread everywhere, how can I be resurrected? Well, here's the picture. God has the power and the ability to take bones from all over different places and bring them together. Do you think if we grind them down into dust that God's no longer able to do it? The point here is that God has the power to resurrect us even if we've been dead for a long time. Even if somebody comes and takes my body in their attempt to mock me in my faith, they tear my body apart and they put it on all different sides of the world, Jesus can still resurrect me. They cannot stop Him. That's the picture of the physical resurrection. The picture of the spiritual resurrection is exactly the same. No matter how dead you are spiritually, in Ephesians 2 and verse 1, we were all dead in our sins and our trespasses. And maybe we're not just dead where we have like one little sin where once we ate from the forbidden tree, but we are so filled with death, so filled with sin, that it seems like there's nothing good within us, no hope. There is nothing that can stop Jesus' power to resurrect. So in John chapter 5, verse 28 and 29 talks about this future picture in which all those who are in the grave will hear and be resurrected. "Do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming in which all who are in the tomb will hear His voice and will come forth, those who did the good deeds to a resurrection of life, those who committed the evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment." Here is this picture of physical resurrection, everybody in the tombs. But in verse 25, He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live." He's not talking about the physical resurrection there. And the key difference there is when He says, "and now is." There's this future resurrection for all of us in regards to our bodies. But He was saying, right now, there's a bunch of the people who are dead, and right now, I'm making them alive. That's the spiritual resurrection. People as separated from God as possibly can be will hear the word of Jesus and can live once more. Which means, never give up on yourself. You're never so far gone that Jesus can't bring you back. And it means, never give up on others. It was a good day for me. It's been a good week. One of the things that was very encouraging to me was listening to Christians talk about family members and the influence that they've had, and how they've helped some people within their family come to Christ. I have some I've given up on. Some where I think, no, the way they think, the way they act, there's just no hope. And I'm dead wrong. Even the dried bones scattered around, at the voice of God, will live again. Don't give up hope. That's really what the message is for me. It gives hope of total, complete restoration for the very, very dead. So in the Old Testament, while we don't always think of the Old Testament resurrection, it's absolutely a message that's through there, and it is way bigger than cell phones. Cell phones made my life easier. This changes everything. We encourage you to follow Christ, to stay close to Christ, to remember that any sacrifice is worth it because the resurrection is true. To remember not to fear any government, not to fear any virus, any illness, not to fear any enemy, because the resurrection is true. I want you to remember to live a life focused on Jesus, because that's all that matters. And don't lose hope. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?